Don't you know the tough thing about a revolution? It sounds like a whisper. Don't you know the tough thing about a revolution? It sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? It sounds like people gonna rise up, get their share. We people gonna rise up and take what's theirs.
Talking about a revolution, Tracy Chapman. Could be a revolution of the mind. It could be a physical revolution in our world. Tracy Chapman talking about a revolution. And welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org. Click on the Listen button. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. Your support keeps us on the air. Unspun is also a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number at the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. You can also send me an email at unspun@kkrn.org. I won't be answering any emails on the air, though. I'll have to look at those later. Today, our guest is David Corton. According to Wikipedia, he is an American economist, author, and former professor of the Harvard Business School, political activist, prominent critic of corporate globalization, and by training and inclination, a student of psychology and behavioral systems. As an author, he has been prescient with his books, When Corporations Rule the World, and Post-Corporate World, Life After Capitalism, and other books, A Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community, and his latest book is An Agenda for a New Economy. He is the founder of Yes Magazine, where he occasionally blogs, and his online homepage is at livingeconomiesforum.org, and I will put links to all of those books and all of those blogs that he is involved with. His experience in the world of finance has led him to believe that capitalism and globalization are leading us to a worldwide failure of social, economic, and environmental systems. He posits that we need to move away from the imperial domination paradigm to one that is based on human needs and our positive, quote, capacities for love, cooperation, and service to community, which defines our true potential. David Corton, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. How are you this morning?
I am good, Doug, and it's a delight to join you. I love the frame of your show, Unspun.
Yeah, I take inspiration sort of from your thoughts among many in the world. I think community service, of course, and having a meaningful life and today is really something to reach for, but there's so many opportunities in the real world to do that right now. I kind of want to start with a little bit about your own personal evolution. And, you know, when you wrote When Corporations Rule the World, it was almost prophetic reading that. I remember it was probably early 2000s that I became aware of it and read it, and at that time, the U.S. had just become the world's sole superpower. And so I was just maybe for our listeners to give them a little bit of your background and how you evolved to the person and the point where you are now in your life.
Okay. Okay, I think we'll probably start with the more recent part, given I'm I'm now 76 years old, so I've got there's a lot of background.
We don't want to use the whole show up on that history. Yeah.
The key thing is that I worked in international development for roughly 30 years, 21 years overseas in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And when time came to recognize how badly our development models were failing, and my field really is organization, so my focus is on how institutions and culture shape human behavior, and I've been looking at that on a global scale writ large. But as I realized that the extent to which the development models were actually creating more desperation, destroying the environment, and breaking down once very solid, beautiful cultures, the question was why. And as I engaged that question, it became clearer and clearer that it was it related very much to a consolidation of corporate power, driven in substantial measure, supported through trade agreements that claimed to be bringing the world together, but were really placing corporations beyond the reach of any sort of democratic accountability or even the market because of the monopoly consolidation of markets. So in 1992, my wife and I decided to move back to the United States from the Philippines, where we were then, and we settled down in an apartment just off Union Square between Madison Avenue and Wall Street, which proved to be a very inspiring location to write when corporations rule the world. About that same time, I got connected with a group that formed the International Forum on Globalization, which became a major player in mobilizing world attention around the consequences of corporate globalization. The ideas from the participants in that further drove the writing of When Corporations Rule the World, which came out in 1995 at kind of exact moment that people are really beginning to question what's going on with these trade agreements, with the outsourcing of jobs, with obscene corporate bonuses and so forth. And that became the basis for the book. But it was also about that same time that I realized that, simply standing in resistance against corporate power is not enough. There have to be alternatives. We have to gain the proactive advantage with a new vision, and it's out of that that I got involved in the founding of Yes Magazine to tell the stories of possibility and what people were doing to bring it into being. Then shortly after that, I met an amazing woman, microbiologist, Maewon Ho, at a conference in Spain, because I had the feeling that the alternative economy, it had to do something with life, with living systems, and yet the only sort of theories of living systems that I was familiar with were the Darwinian theories of basically brutal competition for dominance, and that really didn't sound like the model we were looking for. But when I met Maewon Ho, she exposed me to a whole different biological frame, coming out of the work of biologists like herself that were really studying how life organizes as a system, not just looking at individual species, but looking at the interactions between species on a large scale. And that led to the insights that at the deeper level, life is fundamentally a cooperative activity. Once you really get into understanding living systems, starting with microorganisms, you begin to see that there's certainly competition, but the overall system is fundamentally collaborative when looked at from a deeper level. And that led me to write the Post-Corporate World, Life After Capitalism, which sets forth the living system frame as a foundation for fundamentally rethinking the economy and economics. And interesting to me is that once you begin to look at that and look at how life self-organizes, it really connects in with the original theories of people like Adam Smith and David Ricardo about real market economies and real trade and how economies can self-organize, but they have to be free of monopoly sources, and they also have to be rooted in community and a sense of community accountability and fundamentally community cooperation. So anyhow, that became a theme for quite some time and very focused on the trying to withstand the forces of corporate globalization. And then came 9/11, the terrorist attack. And it's hard recalling back now, but you know, at the time, the sense of fear that many of us had, not of the terrorists, but of our own government and the crackdown on any kind of dissent as an act of terrorism and support for the terrorists, and that disrupted the whole resistance movement globally. And shortly after that, I had a visit from Vandana Shiva, our wonderful Indian colleague and activist, and she was noting that the one reason that the movement went into disarray is because what we were seeing from the Bush administration and many other governments around the world was a resort back to military force and traditional forms of empire and material and imperial domination, and that the frame around which we'd built the global resistance was the economic analysis of the sort that I laid out in When Corporations Rule the World. But that analysis did not address the use of naked military force and the conventional empire frame, which then led me to write The Great Turning, looking at the great sweep of human history over 5,000 years of the development of dominator systems of human organization, where the few rule the many through various forms, including domination by force, but also control of economic power, control of money, getting much of the population into debt, to use debt as a mechanism of control, and also the use of our framing cultural stories to legitimate and justify those systems of domination. And it was back around that time that I started to really become aware of the power of our framing stories, which, of course, is why I so like your theme, Unspun, because, of course, so much of what we get from the corporate media is spinning the stories that lead us into the trap of buying into the systems of domination and buying into and supporting the very economy that is not only pushing many people into extraordinary desperation, but also threatens the total viability of Earth's biosphere, the living systems on which we absolutely depend. So anyhow, and more recently, when we had the financial crash in 2008, my attention turned to what is the response, and the fact that the immediate response is, well, how do we fix Wall Street and get the system back working again? And what I realized in that is that, you know, the crash came because of the very structure, dynamics, and values of Wall Street, and the fact that Wall Street institutions, the banks and the captive corporations, have created a system for making money without producing anything of real value, all accumulating financial credits in the accounts of the already extremely rich, and using the resulting power economically and politically to game the entire system, to assure that all the gains from productivity increases and increases in economic growth go not to the working people who actually create that progress and any related real wealth, but go instead simply to the people who control the creation and allocation of money. And so that got me focused much more on the money system and on the call that the answer is not to try to fix Wall Street. The answer has to be to eliminate that disastrously flawed system and replace it with an economy that is built around true productive labor, real value, which means real things, making sure people have enough food, have shelter, have transportation, have all the things that we actually need for a good life, and with a background recognition that money itself is simply a number. Most of it exists simply as numbers on computer hard drives. It can be a useful accounting system if used responsibly, but used in the way Wall Street uses it, it becomes truly one of the most effective mechanisms of social control ever invented, largely because it's totally invisible.
Let me interrupt you for a second and remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is celebrated author and visionary David Corton. We are discussing how corporations have taken over the world, causing the demise of civilized society and the destruction of the environment. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885. 530-337-1885. If you have questions for David, this is your opportunity. Call in 530-337-1885. When you were talking, I remember when George Bush and the neocons launched their so-called war on terror, they published a document called the National Security Strategy, and I was real curious at that time, and I went back after reviewing your article about a new story, and we're going to get into that new story that we need to be thinking about, but I went back to review that document, and I actually found in there part of their document besides total military domination of the world and destruction of all sovereignty of all nations. That was the, you know, the crux of that mm-hmm. document. But also one of the bullet points was, and this is a quote, ignite a new era of global economic growth through free markets and free trade. So, you know, I think the motivation of, well, not only Bush but so many of our representatives, if we can still call them that, in Congress, and so many people in government and their corporate ties, their motivation doesn't seem to be about us and the welfare of people in the United States or around the world, and so much of it seems to be actually hostile to the biosphere. And I'm of course, this is kind of a lead into what can we do? What are the real, very real, and I know you're an expert on all of this, what are the very real ways to turn this around, to empower people and to get to a point where we can have a positive way to be in the world?
Yeah, that is the question, and it is very hard. Well, I can give you some very simple frames for how we think about it, but of course we have to recognize that behind that, the deeper you get into this, the more you realize how much has to change in terms of the framing stories of our culture, the structure of our institutions, the way we structure education, the whole structure and foundation of our legal system. Because the further you get into it, the more you realize that the extent to which in all of these areas, the way we organize currently, the stories we're conditioned to all essentially support the path that we're on toward self-annihilation. But the change starts with a new story. You know, we have been conditioned to this very familiar story that time is money. Money is wealth. Money is the measure of wealth. Making money creates wealth and is the defining purpose of the individual, business, and the economy. You know, Milton Friedman literally said that, you know, it's the moral duty of the business person to maximize their profit and to do anything else is literally immoral. then we're taught that material consumption is the path to happiness, and that we humans are by nature individualistic and competitive, and this is all to the good because this invisible hand of the free market will direct that insatiable competitive drive to ends that maximize the wealth of all. Inequality is actually an advantage because it gives you rich people who can invest in creating the jobs and wealth for all. Economic growth will eventually end poverty and heal the environment. Now, I'm sure most of your listeners are sophisticated enough that as you hear each element, they can recognize immediately that those elements are false. They're misleading, they're immoral, they're ultimately built based on a set of economic theories and an economic story that constitutes nothing less than intellectual fraud. But that is the story that is continuously reinforced in the corporate media spin. And we so seldom hear the alternatives spoken that we tend either to embrace them or resign ourselves to it. Now, the change begins with the new story, the essential elements, recognizing, first of all, that we humans are living beings. That's the start of it. And as living beings, we survive and prosper only as contributing members of a living Earth community, which exists within a living, self-organizing cosmos that is evolving toward ever greater beauty, complexity, awareness, and possibility. We need to recognize in this new story that science now affirms that it is actually our true human nature to care and to share. The characteristics associated with the economic man, the ruthless pursuit of greed and individualism and individual advantage, are characteristics of the psychopath and the sociopath. People who are deeply mentally disturbed. And we need to create a society that nurtures and honors the truly mature human person who is a caring person, who is a giving person, who gets satisfaction from being of service to their fellow man, to their neighbor, to the community. That is how we are actually wired, and that is the essential foundation of a moral functioning economy. Now, you get into that, and you begin to realize that the only legitimate purpose of any human institution, whether it's business, government, or civil society, is to facilitate our participation as effective, creative contributors to the well-being of our community and to the creation of community wealth and sustaining that well-being. Now, the economy that is comprised of these institutions, its job is, again, to support us in being of service. And every one of our institutions should be measured not on how much profit it can extract from the community, but how much it can contribute to the overall well-being of the community. Now, this is not to say we need to do away with profit, but we need to recognize that profit is a means and a reward, and that a business needs to get a modest, a sufficient profit to survive, but that is very different from maximizing profit. Another key piece is ownership is foundational. You know, I often say that I believe in private property. I think private property is such a good thing that everyone should have some. And that is basically the foundation of Adam Smith's concept of a true market economy. He was very suspicious of any firm that was larger than one person, the very small business that's owned by the manager who does most of the work. And there is a kind of a simple ideal in that we should all participate in the ownership of the means of production on which our own livelihood depends. And we should be working as part of a community, a moral community. And within that frame, profits, interest, just keep circulating within the community, because there is no class distinction between owners and workers. But when you get the kind of situation we have now, where we have this huge class division between people who live by their labor and those who simply live from returns to financial assets, and the flow of interest and profits is all one way and leads to this extraordinary concentration of wealth and power that is now literally destroying civilization.
And I can think of so many, the Walmart situation, the big box stores in every small town. Some of these things are so indicative of what's wrong, and the very fact that so little is returned to the community and so much taken away, and so much taken right off the top to make just a few very wealthy and very powerful. And this seems to be a paradigm that is embraced. I know in our small town here in Reading, it's only about 90,000 people, but basically the staff and the representatives of our local governments totally embrace this idea of the big box store is somehow going to make us a better place. And it's so contrary to what appears obvious. And as you say, I couldn't find it in the article you provided me, A New Story for a New Economy, but what we're talking about is a story that really rings true in our hearts. If we know it, we can feel the truth of it, even though we can't necessarily see it around us. I've been in a couple of major earthquakes. I haven't been in a tsunami, but I think anybody that's been in a basically maybe a tragic situation, but it brings forth heroism. The average person is very heroic. And I think people that have been in those situations understand that there really is something very noble and heroic about every person. And when it comes right down to it, people are really willing to give their lives for others.
Yeah, that's very true. This is tapping into to the reality, which is often in contrast with academic theories, particularly the academic theories of economists.
Well, yes, I think that the competitive story, the Darwinian story, which was really the social Darwinism in my mind, is really a distortion of Darwin's theory, because Darwin doesn't say survival of the strongest or the most brutish or the biggest. It's the survival of the most adaptive. And I think people lose sight of that fact. So how does do we have some real examples? First of all, let me take a little break because we are at the bottom of the hour. But I want to come back to some of the real examples of what we're talking about here. And in the meantime, I have to do a couple of announcements real quick, and then we'll come back to you, David. One announcement here is tonight, which we had a little announcement on air just before my show, but tonight the Late Night Poetry Jam with Pamela Spoto is going to be on at 10 p.m. on this station. And she has Scott Yates, a local English professor, on with her, and they will be discussing and reading poems of revolution and social consciousness from around the world. I think it's a great show. Of course, I'm biased because I help produce the show, but that's no reason to not listen in. It's one of those shows that helps you open up your mind and kind of understand how we are all linked in the world. The other announcement I have here is that there is a forum about guns and their place in society today at the Pilgrim Congregational Church on Foothill Boulevard in Reading. It consists of four panelists: Patrick Henry Jones, our gun shop owner and city council member; Amanda Wilcox, Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence representative; Donald Ewart, Director of Health and Human Services for Shasta County; and Tom Bosenko, Shasta County Sheriff. And the moderator is Bruce Ross, a Record Searchlight editorial editor. So that is today at 12:30 p.m. At the Pilgrim Congregational Church, 2850 Foothill Boulevard in Redding, California. You can call 530-242-0309, 242-0309 for more information about that event. Well, you are listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett, with us today, celebrated author, prescient author, and David Corden. He is with us, and we're discussing alternatives to today's economy and how that's going to serve us and serve the world better. So, David, we see the results of globalization. We see that it doesn't look like our leaders are going to go in any direction to reverse that. In fact, it looks like with the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's on the table right now, that we're going to see more trade agreements. We're going to see more empowerment of the World Trade Organization. We're going to see more people in poverty, more austerity, more of a lot of negative things as a direct result of these policies. And so, you know, how do we move forward at a local level? So many of the people at the local level are suffering because the money has been drained off at the local level and continues to be. So how do we move out of that old paradigm and embrace the new story, the new paradigm, in a practical way at the local level?
Yeah, huge question again. I'm glad you mentioned the trade agreements because they are truly diabolical. It is unfathomable to me that any responsible politician could in good faith vote for one of these trade agreements that's been negotiated in secret by transnational corporations and presented to us under a take it or leave it fast track rule. Because these agreements are, in the end, about nothing other than simply consolidating corporate power and holding them immune from any kind of market or democratic accountability. I think we really need to be out there with the message that any politician who's willing to support one of these agreements, particularly under fast track rules, is not fit to hold public office. It comes down; it's as simple as that. Now, the start on the solution is to recognize that the fundamental difference. The story I first outlined, the standard economic story, I call the sacred money and market story. We have a deep human need for a sense of what is most important. What is our moral guide? And I'm struck by the Pope's recent homily in which he noted, it's not money that's evil, it is the worship of money, the evil. It is idolatrous, it is the worship of false idols, and it's totally on the mark in terms of what we face. That we need to create a society, we create an economy around a recognition that life is sacred, that Earth's community of life is sacred. These are what is most important. These are the things that we must value. So the real key to the solution, and it is coming, of course, not from our politicians in Washington, but from local people and those local governments that have a deeper sense of the future and their responsibility to their people. And in a sense, it is creating our new economy, our own economies, people-centered, life-centered economies around community that are as independent of Wall Street as possible. Rebuilding our food system so that we are, growing local food with local farmers, processing it through local businesses that are either owned directly by local people, individual smaller businesses or larger firms that are owned around various kinds of cooperative ownership models. And the basic idea is to rebuild our food systems, rebuild our local financial systems, rebuild our local community communication systems, of which your station is a prime example. build our local green energy systems around solar and wind, and of course all sorts of conservation measures, doing all of this in ways that limit our dependence on the Wall Street institutions that use their control of our access to money to control our life energy, to control our local resources. Now, ownership is very key, and it, you know, all these things I'm talking about are, there's nothing here that is easy, because the forces that be, the kinds of folks that you talked about that wrote this Bush administration plan for global domination, they have essentially written our rules. They have written our laws, and they have written them to make it very difficult to do the things that we now must do. As you noted, they've also trained our city officials to think in terms of service to that predatory global system rather than actual service to their own communities. And, you know, I'm running into this right now in my own community on Bainbridge Island, that the people are developing an amazing vision of the island that we want, the community that we want, an economy that is rooted in good values, rooted in local people, rooted in local resources. And we seem to have a city staff that is really aligning with the corporate box store interests that are eager to colonize our community. But any sets of initiatives that are bringing economic control back into the community and thinking in terms of living systems. We need to get control of our money, but the goal of our local economy is not to make money. It is to create and serve life. It is to build community. It is to build our self-reliance and our ability to meet our needs within the frame of our community's local resources, our people, our land, our water, our natural systems. All of this recognizing that, again, that as a species, our health and well-being depend on the health and vitality of Earth's living systems, the generative systems by which Earth continuously regenerates our clean water, regenerates our soils, captures and distributes and utilizes and stores solar energy in its various forms. We've gotten so focused on money that we have come to assume that money is the key, and making money is the key, so then the folks who control the money dangle that in front of us, and we forget, oh, I'm a living person. My well-being depends on having healthy food. My happiness depends very much on having strong, caring, being members of a strong, caring community in which we support each other. Ultimately, my very survival depends on the health of the natural systems in my community, the cleanliness of our water and our air, the natural fertility and vitality of our soils. And so we begin to think about what are the ways we can manage those resources locally in ways that meet our needs in balance and work with the natural forces of nature rather than in opposition to them. It's a fundamental shift in mental focus it starts with. But once you get that shift in mind, everything else follows. And we can begin to see those paths that are beneficial, that are restoring the natural systems of Earth, that are restoring the relationships of community, that are creating a degree of local self-reliance that's eliminating our dependence on these predatory Wall Street institutions. Now, I actually want to comment on globalization, because the problem is not globalization per se. We do live in an interdependent world, and the people that I worked with in resisting the corporate globalization are among the most internationally minded people in the world. But we came to realize that there's two totally conflicting visions of a global society, of bringing the world together. One is the corporate vision in which the corporations are in control, the globalization of corporate power. The other is a global civilization based on the globalization of people power, which means the globalization of deep democracy, which means a world of interconnected local communities, each of which is attempting to meet its own needs to the extent possible within the limits of its own resources, but is also sharing ideas, sharing technology, trading at the margin with other similar communities to the benefit of all, which is actually the frame that is most consistent with both market theory and trade theory. But it is also the system that aligns best with the original visions of our great economic thinkers. And interestingly enough, as you suggested, Darwin himself, who really, so far as I'm aware, and as you suggest, recognize that there is a dimension of love and cooperation to life that those who have interpreted his stories have completely missed. And it's, you know, again, the issue of spin, it is so interesting to see how the foundational messages of Darwin, of Adam Smith, of Jesus, of our other leaders from the past, thinkers from the past that we now so venerate, but in so many instances have totally distorted and diminished their true ideas, their true meaning, their true story.
Well, it's the tendency of those who have control over the major portion of our communications, especially in the United States. Of course, their focus is profit and propaganda. They're not serving us, which is one reason that little community stations like this popped up. This station's only a few years old, but people here, and we're a fairly small community, we recognize that need to have a community voice to tell a different story, because so much of the story we hear doesn't even approach reality. It's fantasy propaganda for the most part, and so there's such a need to get voices like yours out and get people to start thinking about the other possibilities, because we are going down a dead-end street. We've got a caller on the air. I don't know who it is yet, but I'm going to try to bring that caller on the air. Okay. And Dennis, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh,
to
hi.
Unspun. Hi. That was quick, huh?
Yeah, I was just curious. There were a couple of notions that had popped in my mind. The one on the cooperation, Robert Wright wrote a great book called Non-Zero, The Non-Zero Sum. Are you familiar with that?
No, I am not familiar with that particular book.
Okay.
I'm certainly familiar with Robert.
He basically talks pretty much along the same lines you are regarding cooperative markets, the cooperative evolution of in nature. It's done more in the area of symbiosis,
mm-hmm, right?
Rather than the survival of the fittest, though the survival of the fittest obviously occurred at some level. There is a lot of symbiosis and cooperation through the evolution and so forth. But anyway, the book's a great one that you might want to. His name is Robert Wright. The other notion, I guess, that pops in is when you talk about the connectivity of small units, economically local small units, the issues of scale, the population explosion in the world. There's some huge issues when it comes to scale and being involved with international corporations. I worked for Boeing. Huge effort, and so I'm familiar with that international issue when it comes to trying to do big things smaller organizations having a more difficult time doing that? And how would you address the issue of scale?
Good question.
You know, it's interesting. When we get into these conversations, you know, I'm kind of used to people raising how would we produce our airplanes, which is a very interesting question. I mean, clearly a larger scale is required. Probably not the scale of a Boeing, but you know, my first answer to that is our first issue is not how to build our airplanes. One of the things that we're going to have to get used to as we deal with the issue of bringing ourselves back into balance with nature is we're going to have to do a whole lot less flying. And I can tell you from my own experience, you know, for many years working internationally, it was almost a monthly experience for me getting on a plane and flying the other side of the world. I've now arranged my life so that most of what I do is like what we're doing right now, communication by telephone and Skype and so forth. And I've cut back from 2 airplane trips a month to maybe 1 every 3 months. And boy, has my life improved. First of all, making airplanes then should not be our first issue. But on the things that do require that kind of scale, there are ways to do it's to organize around cooperative ownership. I'm fascinated by the Mondragon Cooperatives model of worker ownership, which demonstrate the capacity to organize cooperative ownership, sometimes on quite a large scale. The key here is ownership in the hands of people, first of all, democratically distributed, but it is also rooting it in people who live in the community where their assets are located and who have a direct interest in the health of their communities, the health of their neighbor, their children, their own local natural environment, so that they're using the powers and the rights of ownership in ways that actually serve their community rather than simply trying to extract as much profit. And, of course, Boeing has demonstrated itself as a kind of iconic example of a global corporation that is ready to pick up at an instant's moment and transfer jobs to places where it can get a better deal, get lower taxes so it's not paying for its share of the upkeep of society, places where it doesn't have to worry about environmental regulations and so forth. To the extent that we build our businesses around local ownership, even those on a larger scale, we begin to get a totally different calculus into decision making, and we also begin to get decisions made on the base of a stability of procurement. You build your system of procurement around businesses that have a sense of mutual concern and partnership for their mutual long-term benefit as the cooperatives and Mondragon are organized. So very complex issue, but they're the worst possible way to organize ownership is the system we have now of the instantaneous public trading of shares, most of it done by computers that don't even care what business they're trading. It's simply based on algorithms tracking price movements of whatever the piece of paper is. And yes, that system absolutely disconnects the powers and decision-making related to ownership from any sense of human conscience or sensibility, moral sensibility. So that has to change.
I agree. I guess what I was trying to wean out here is that we have cooperative spirit. There has to be central planning when you have scale or you're trying to organize around diverse groups.
Oh, yeah.
This problem of central planning. And of course, and then the government or administration says raising the federal head. So I guess what I'm trying to say is there's a point of diminishing returns somewhere where you end up having to have some type of central planning or central organization for common issues that occur between different economic systems. And
That's absolutely true, but it can be done in a more democratic way.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and they, I haven't actually visited them, but you know, things like the manufacturing networks in northern Italy and so forth. But no, you're quite right. If you're going to build an airplane, ultimately all the pieces have to fit together, and they have to come together at the right time. But of course, it's very different if the firm is owned by the workers who recognize, understand that, and they hire managers to do it, but they also hire the managers accountable for doing it in a way that also honors the needs and interests of the people and the communities that are contributing to the production of those parts and to their ultimate assembly.
Yeah.
And, of course, what we see in the Boeing management is that not only are they not accountable, but they've actually done a pretty lousy job on their procurement and putting the pieces together in a way that works.
Well, let me interrupt here. We do have another caller, and I hope, Dennis, that answered your question, and I wanted to get to this other caller because we're running out of time.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for your astute observations there, Dennis. Very good.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I enjoy your show. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Let's bring Pamela. Pamela, you're on the air with David Corton.
Well, good morning, thank you for this wonderful show. And David Corton is articulate and brilliant. I'm totally enjoying what he has to say. I do have a question, and the question is, you know, with all, I totally agree that institutions within our culture have to be redone in a way that support this life-giving back to nature, caring about the health of communities, but it is so difficult to even get started. You know, as he said, his own city council, you know, is kind of, using the word stonewalling, and I see us running up against corporate media. We can't change people's minds and to hear the truth until we can get the word out. And so I'm wondering what he might say in terms of just getting started to change people's minds. It's very, very difficult. Even in the educational arena, which I work in.
Well, it's interesting that you mention education because, again, our whole education system is organized around siloed disciplines, particularly when you get into higher education.
Yes.
So, I'm sure the thing you've run into, we're not teaching students how to think. We're teaching to standardized tests and memorization and all that nonsense. The changing the larger story, a thing that's so interesting to me during my lifetime, having seen the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union, the fall of apartheid in South Africa, even the decolonization of India, in all of these instances. We had a population that was up against a totally controlled media, even controlled more than what we confront now in the United States. And yet they were able to change the story and achieve abrupt change through communication channels that were not controlled by the media. Now, I've also so struck, having truly lived through the emergence of the internet. First of all, moving from international communication by telex machines in the Philippines to the early internet in the late 1980s and early 90s in Philippines and Indonesia. Our total global situation has been fundamentally transformed by the internet. If we can keep it an open communication media, we do have a means to communicate with one another instantaneously, even as a global society, pretty much free of the filters of corporate media. Now, of course, we're seeing this move by the corporations to take over and control the content of the Internet, which would be horrendous. And we must absolutely fight that. But the key thing is more of a standing up and sharing these stories. And I think part of it is finding the courage to, I mean, a lot of us in the progressive movement tend to shy away from talking about the sacred. What do we hold to be sacred? What do we hold to be most valuable? And right at the right at the core of this, what do we hold money or do we hold life to be our object, our sacred veneration?
Let me interrupt, and we have one more call, and that will be the last caller. I hope that answered your questions and your concerns, Pamela.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, let me, one last caller, and it'll have to be just a short one. Bob, we have time for a very quick question. You're on the air.
A quick question. How come we don't have more community currencies, local currencies, trade token systems set up? What's the difficulty with that? Why don't we have that in every town?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a big conversation. They are very difficult to make work. I used to be a major fan and proponent of community currencies, but one of the things I've come to realize is that the official money system is the system of control, and we have to get control of that. And that the real problem we've gotten into is when I grew up, we had a system of community banks. Most states had a rule, if you had a bank, you had one, there were no branches, you had one physical facility. And that physical facility was locally owned, and it was taking in savings and creating credit and loans for local businesses and local home ownership. And that system worked extraordinarily well. Then Wall Street deregulated, we had the concentration of control of banking and the creation of money, and shifting from real investment to playing financial games, and that goes right to the heart of our problem. And if you want to get further into this, Google my name and look for How to Liberate America from Wall Street Rule. How to Liberate America from Wall Street Rule, and you'll see a report that I wrote as part of the New Economy Working Group on how our whole money system was corrupted and what we need to do to rebuild a system of local financial institutions that actually trade in the official currency but reroute its control and creation in the community.
David, we have 1 minute, and so I'm just going to ask you to what's the message you would like to leave us with today?
Well, it's so interesting to me that the fundamental principles boil down to are very simple. We have a choice between money or life as our guiding framing value. We have to rethink our whole system of rules based on foundational truths, and one that is most central is without nature, there are no people. Without people, there are no corporations. Ultimately, we have to put nature first, and that means the health and vitality of Earth's natural living systems. We have to work with those in ways that meet human needs, meet the human needs of everyone, and we need to recognize that corporations are simply human creations, and the only legitimate reason for them to exist is to serve our needs and to be totally accountable to people who at the same time recognize their accountability to and dependence on Earth's natural systems. That is the ultimate framework, and to the extent we organize within that framework, we've got a pathway out of the mess we're in.
Well, I have to kind of end the show here. That little bit of music you heard in the background was our cue to kind of fade out. So, David Corden, I want to thank you very much for being on Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling with us today.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll get to speak again. Very enjoyable and an honor to speak with you, and I'm sure it was very informative for our listeners. So maybe we'll do this again.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. We have that standing ovation of one in the studio. Thank you, and we'll talk again. Well, you've been listening to Unspun, an Experiment of Truth Telling. That was our guest, David Corden. I will archive this show, and I will also put links in those archives to David's websites and to Yes Magazine, which he helped found, and several other organizations you might want to get more information from.